I appreciate the opportunity to stand before you this afternoon. I know this is a difficult time. You're having just had lunch. I was looking for a cup of coffee earlier. I knew that I needed to stay awake at this hour, but I got there too late. It was already gone. So if I fall asleep, I hope that you'll excuse me. Just somebody kind of nudge me, and we'll continue on. The subject for this hour, I admit, I'll have a difficult time remembering how to pronounce it, because I've heard it pronounced a number of different ways. Sharia, Sharia, Sharia. I guess all of those might be correct concerning. It just depends on who you're asking. But maybe you've never heard of that, but I would suggest that you have heard of this law. You remember news stories, surely, or newspaper articles wherein you read about a thief's hand being cut off, or fingers being cut off. You've read about that or heard about that, right? Well, you've heard something about the subject under consideration this afternoon. That's what we're talking about. Actually, that's just a portion of the law about which we're studying this afternoon, but we'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. We'll narrow some things down, and then we'll broaden some things back out and just kind of follow along. Hopefully, you'll be able to do that. First of all, let me go ahead and kind of describe to you some things that I saw when I first started studying this subject. I was on the internet, I put in the word, and I was looking for the severe punishments of the Sharia. And the images that were plastered on my computer screen are images that most of us Americans in the 21st century would probably see only in a horror movie if we care anything about those kinds of movies. For example, I saw a picture of a woman who really did not look like a woman. She looked more like a mummy, the way that her skin had formed. You see, she had been set on fire. But previous to her having been set on fire, she was strung upside down by a jealous husband who had accused her of cheating on her. He strung her upside down, beat her, sliced her nose off of her face, and then set her on fire. And she survived. Oh, I forgot. He also gouged out her eyes. She survived. That was one of the images that was plastered on my computer screen. Another image was of a man kneeling down in a floor. His back was facing the camera. He had pulled his shirt up, and it was nothing but blood and opened wounds from the top of his shoulders down to his waistband. I don't know if it was better for me to speak before lunch or after lunch, if it was better for you to lose your appetite or to lose your lunch. Another image. There was a young man walking through a street, and he had something tied, a rope tied to his finger, and he had it over his shoulder like this. And it reminded me of someone who had just come back from the fishing hole. Except on the end of that rope, there weren't fish, there were severed hands. And then one final picture that I saw was this. It was a crowd gathered in a Middle Eastern street surrounding a group of men who were holding up the intestines and other internal organs of slaughtered enemies. Prizes. All of those are images of the subject that we're studying this afternoon. And perhaps maybe the first thing that you're thinking of, when I'm going to ask you this, do you think that's biblical? Do you think it's right for those individuals to punish evildoers in that way? And surely the first thing that comes to your mind is, why, no, the scriptures teach that we are to be merciful and kind. But I would suggest for you to think back on some of the things that have already been stated this morning. As a matter of fact, the first subject that was studied, we were reminded that there are some occasions in the scriptures where brutality existed even at the command of God. I think about 1 Samuel chapter 17 and a man by the name of David, you know him, a man described as being one after God's own heart. You remember what he did with the head of Goliath? Sliced it from his shoulders. Seems rather brutal, doesn't it? And then you turn to the next chapter, and what do you find? You find that he brought hundreds of foreskins of the slaughtered soldiers to King Saul. It's rather brutal. Well, maybe those things weren't justified by God. Maybe those were simply actions that David did that did not have the approval of heaven. But remember again what we heard this morning. And rightly so. We think about the conquest of Canaan. We think about King Saul and how God ordered him to utterly destroy the Amalekites, even children. That's brutal, isn't it? So can we, on the very surface of the brutality under consideration concerning this law, can we say that it's wrong? I would say no. In all fairness, no. Now somebody's going to say, yeah, but that was the Old Testament. We're under the New Testament now. Romans chapter 1. Beginning at about verse 29, we read that certain evildoers are worthy of death. Capital punishment. And you remember the list there. So can we say on the surface again that this law is wrong because it prescribes the punishment and even the deaths of evildoers, of those who are unrighteous? I think that if we're honest, we cannot say that that makes it wrong just because it seems to be brutal. Now, I want to start this thing out this afternoon by making you wonder whether I'm for this thing or against it. That's going to make you pay attention, I hope. And I'll answer that question at the end. So you've got to stay tuned. Let me go ahead and mention this. Do you think that there is a lot of problems with stealing in those countries where these laws are enacted? No, not at all. As a matter of fact, the majority of things that are considered to be crimes in accordance with this very law and with the Quran and some other sources that we're going to notice a little bit later, crime is not a huge problem. So we could say, listen, this thing works. It somewhat lines up with some things that we find in the Bible. So again, are we supposed to be for it or are we supposed to be against it? We have to cover some other ground before we can really answer that question adequately and properly. First of all, let's start with an explanation of the expression. Usually, as we've stated time and time again in studies like this, the best way to begin a study of a particular topic is by defining the terms involved. We only have one, so this is easy. What does this term, Sharia, however you pronounce it, what does it mean? Well, it's an Arabic term that simply means path. That's it. Nothing more, nothing less. The term originally referred to the well-worn paths made by camels that led to watering places. So this word that signifies the way to water symbolizes, in the mind of the Muslim, it symbolizes the way to God. One writer says this, he makes this connection between the original meaning of the word path and path to water, and the Islamic application, the way to God. He made this application. He says, just as water purifies and gives growth and development to all creation, so the Sharia gives growth to human relationships and to our development as trustees of God. The Muslim views this law as a complete set of laws for the guidance of mankind. And by complying with this law, he lives a life that is complete and ideal and in line with the will of Allah. Listen, if you will, to this quote. The supreme goal of the Sharia is the welfare of the people in this world and in the hereafter. Broadly speaking, the needs of the community are classified into dire necessities, ordinary necessities, and complementary needs, those things that make life more enjoyable, in that order of significance. Now, in topping that list, those things that are of dire necessity, he says there is the list of the five aims of the Sharia. The objectives of the Sharia then have to do with the preservation and the protection of life. That's what it's for. Mind, the preservation and protection of mind. Of religion, ownership and possession. And then number five, procreation and preservation of the species. Each of these is divided into sets and branching subsets until seemingly small details are reached and each is serviced by appropriate moral and or legal rulings. That's what this law is all about. It makes the Muslim complete. Now, moving to our second point, there are some clarifications that we need to consider. By defining the term that we just mentioned, by reading the quote that I just read, we discover that there's more to this law than just the floggings and the stonings and the amputations. There's more to this law than just the severe punishments that you and I are familiar with. It's a lot broader than that. Remember, I said we're going to kind of back up and see the big picture first. It's a lot broader than just these severe punishments. When considering the Sharia, one would do well to think of it as the entire body of truth for the Muslim. Now, somebody's thinking, I thought that was the purpose of the Quran. Yes and no. And we'll clarify that in a few minutes. See, you're going to have to pay attention in order to get all of this. The Quran factors into this, but we'll notice how in just a moment. The Sharia includes many of the well-known and often studied subjects of Islam. The entire body of truth for the Muslim. It includes the five pillars. It includes jihad that was mentioned just a few moments ago. It includes worship. It includes diet and clothing. It includes the status of women and a number of other things. That's the first clarification. Number two, there is more to Islam and the Sharia than what might be called spiritual mandates. Keep that in mind. We need to remember that in Islam there is no what we would call separation of church and state. It's more properly defined, Islam is, as a theocracy. Which is interesting when you have Muslims living in countries that are not theocratic in nature. And makes it quite scary when you consider what Brother Price mentioned just a few moments ago about the desires and the aims of those living in these countries. Well, the Sharia regulates every aspect of the Muslim's life. It deals with public life as well as private life. It regulates the individual as well as the state. It tells the individual what he must do in terms of hygiene, in terms of diet, sex, child rearing, you name it. As a matter of fact, I came across an article concerning, I guess, hygiene. I don't know where exactly this would fall in, but I'll go ahead and read parts of it. The headline is this: Teenager's haircut given the chop. A Malaysian teenager was given a forced haircut by Muslim authorities who deemed his punk-style mohawk un-Islamic. The 17-year-old is reported to be a high school dropout. He was nabbed by the Islamic Development Unit of Kota Baru, Kelantan. I don't even know if that's how you pronounce it, but that's a northeastern state controlled by a particular Islamic political party. And the aim of this political party is to introduce this law that we're studying across the country of Malaysia. So here's an area where it applied. They didn't chop the guy's head off or hands off. They just chopped his mohawk off. But it dealt with even that part. The way a person dresses, and so on. So we see it as a little bit broader than just the severe punishments that we're talking about. It also tells the state how to engage in and how to settle international conflicts, disputes, and wars, and it dictates how to treat criminals, adulterers, and apostates. A logical question then becomes this: where do we find the Sharia? When I was first assigned this topic on another lectureship, that's the first thing that came to my mind. Now, where do I find this book? You can't find the book. Because you see, the sources of the statutes are a compilation. They include the Quran. We mentioned that a moment ago, and you're familiar with that. Therein we find Sharia. Therein we find this law. But also we find it in the Sunnah, Ijma, and Qiyas. What are the Sunnah? These are the records and deeds, or the records of the deeds and words of Muhammad. Each of these individual records is called a hadith or kadis. I don't know again how you want to pronounce that. But these are binding traditions that were recorded by the companions of Muhammad. These are the traditions that go along and beside of the Quran. So here we have a second source. We've got the Quran and we've got the Sunnah, which includes the Hadiths. And then we've got this other source, the Ijma. These are consensus. It is a term applied to the consensus of the Muslim community as to the rightness or wrongness of certain things. Also, these are statements agreed upon by leading companions of Muhammad. So we have our own contemporary scholars, Islamic scholars and community that decides what's right and what's wrong. And then we have those individuals that were companions of Muhammad when he was alive. Sometimes these two things don't line up and we have contradictions that come about. Big surprise. False religions are filled with contradictions, right? So we have this source. And then finally, there are the qiyas. The qiyas are the conclusions relating to earlier decisions in Islam based on applications of teachings found in the Quran, the Sunnah, and the Ijma. So here are the sources. We have their holy book, the Quran. We have the sayings and actions of Muhammad, these various traditions. We have the consensus of the community and or of the companions of Muhammad. And we also have the previous legal decisions that have been made throughout the centuries, whether they're recent ones or ones that were made years and years ago. All of these things combined, and by the way, some groups would even throw in a couple of other sources. All of these sources combined make up the Sharia. That's where this comes from. Now, let's talk about the placement of punishment in Islam. Ideally, there is an order in Islam to hinder transgression. That is, there are other certain things that are placed in the way of transgressions that are hopefully work to stop transgressions from taking place. One source puts it this way: Islam curbs crime by three defense lines. Number one, the cultivation of Islamic conscience, education and guidance. Maybe we would say evangelism. Number two, there is the prevention of the causes that might lead to crime, social and economic. And then comes legal punishment in that sequence. Now, there's another thing that comes along that we might call edification that needs to be placed in there. Other individuals will encourage their Muslim brothers and sisters to do the right thing and to stay away from the wrong thing. All of these things are designed to curb crime, to stop it from taking place. But what happens when it is not stopped? Then come these severe punishments. Then it's time to engage in what we might call severe punishments. Now, let's go ahead and notice some of the types of transgressions. Under this law, there are three main categories of crime. There are the most serious, there are offenses of retribution, and then there are the least serious. Concerning the first topic, the most serious crimes, these include adultery, fornication, drinking of alcohol, theft. We could probably stop right there and say those are very serious. We would agree. And certainly things ought to be done to curb those transgressions, to stop those things from happening. But this also includes these most serious crimes, include rebellion against Islamic authority and apostasy. The penalties for these transgressions include flogging, stoning, amputation, and death. Now, when we keep in mind that the interpretation and the application of Islamic law is not consistent throughout the Muslim world, it's not surprising for us to learn that some laws are either totally ignored or altered by various groups. For example, even though the Sharia calls for the death of impenitent apostates, one man said, and I quoted him in the book, he said that this law is now obsolete. That's not true. There are plenty of Muslim countries in this world where apostates, those that leave the Islamic faith, are put to death. A few days ago, someone came by the office and handed me a magazine, and I think it's called The Voice of the Martyrs. It's a denominational magazine, and so when it talks about Christians, it's talking about, you know, Christendom in that sense, all of those who profess to be followers of Christ. And it lists all of the crimes against these individuals throughout the world. There are people being put to death left and right who claim to be followers of Christ, and they're being put to death by Muslims. It's taking place. I know that that's not on the 6 o'clock news, but it's happening. It's definitely happening. Now, the next category of crimes are offenses of retribution. These are premeditated murder, seemingly premeditated murder, erroneous murder, and other intended or unintended crimes. Concerning penalties under this category of crimes, victims or relatives in cases of murder, they have the option of retribution, blood money, or neither. And then the final category, the least serious crimes, those are decided upon by various judges. Now, for the sake of reference, if you will, listen to some of these passages. I'm going to take these passages from the Quran and also from those traditions that I mentioned a little while ago, the hadiths. First of all, Surah 537. Only the recompense of those who war against God and His apostle and go about to commit disorders in the earth shall be they that shall be slain or crucified or have their alternate hands and feet cut off or be banished from the land. This their disgrace in this world and in the next a great torment shall be there. So this seems to imply that those who go against Islam and perhaps cause disorder in the Islamic world as a result of their rebellion, they're to be put to death, or they are to have their hands and feet cut off, alternate hands or feet. Surah 438, but chide those women for whose refractoriness ye have cause to fear, remove them into beds apart and scourge them. Remember the woman that I mentioned a little while ago, whose nose was chopped from her face? Keep in mind that there are certain tribal traditions, including honor killings that take place, that might hide behind some perversions of Sharia, or according to this verse, might be in line with that law. Surah 542, as to the thief, whether man or woman, cut ye off their hands in recompense for their doings. This is a penalty by way of warning from God Himself, and God is mighty, wise. Surah 24:2, the whore and whoremonger, scourge each of them with 100 stripes, and let not compassion keep you from carrying out the sentence of God. If ye believe in God in the last day, and let some of the faithful witness their chastisement. Surah 24:4, those who defame virtuous women and bring not four witnesses, scourge them with 80 stripes, and receive ye not their testimony forever, for these are perverse persons. Surah 66:9, O Prophet, make war. This is a passage that is very familiar to most of us. O Prophet, make war on the infidels and hypocrites, and deal rigorously with them. Hell shall be their abode, and wretched the passage thereof, or to it. Now we go to the hadiths. Volume 8, Book 81, number 765. He mentions a particular man, An-Numan, or his son, was brought to the Prophet on a charge of drunkenness. So the Prophet ordered all the men present in the house to beat him. So all of them beat him, and I was also one of them who beat him. Listen to this, who beat him with shoes. How many of you saw that image of Saddam Hussein after our troops got into Baghdad and got into Iraq? I don't remember exactly which town it was, but they were taking off their sandals, the Iraqis were, and they were slapping the face of Saddam Hussein, this big painting on the wall. And they very well may have also done it, I can't quite remember, to that statue, you remember, that they pulled down. They may have even beat that statue with their shoes. Well, the beating with the shoe part is a tradition there. But we find that practice taking place here in these traditions. One person said this in another hadith. We used to strike the drunks with our hands, shoes, clothes, by twisting it into the shape of lashes during the lifetime of the prophet Abu Bakr and the early part of the Umar's caliphate. But during the last period, he used to give the drunk 40 lashes. And when drunks became mischievous and disobedient, he used to scourge them 80 lashes. Now see, again, I have to ask you, are you for this thing or against it? I think some folks ought to be beaten for the way they act and for the things that they do. Is it necessarily wrong? We'll get to that. Stay tuned. Also, Volume 8, Book 81, Number 780. The prophet said the hand should be cut off for stealing something that is worth a quarter of a dinar or more. And I've got some more in the book. You might want to take a look at those. Well, I've got maybe just one more. But either way, that gives you a sampling of the various reasons why these practices take place. Now, those are just from two sources that make up the Sharia. And again, we need to remember all of these other sources that come into play. Now, let me go ahead and mention again that there are those who distort and or misuse the Sharia to justify acts that are even more severe than those that we mentioned just here. And opposers, for example, the Taliban. You've probably seen the images. I think they were on television, and I saw them when I was doing the research. I saw them on the internet. When they were in power of Afghanistan, they owned or took charge of the soccer stadium. And you remember that they would have public executions and beatings in that soccer stadium. And I remember that there were two or three women that were brought out. They were placed on their knees and their heads were blown off with shotguns. Well, with other guns. You remember that. Some would say concerning this group, the Taliban, that they did not exactly go through the right procedures. They would do certain things to thieves. The problem is, their opposers say, that they did not provide a healthy economy for the people. See, that had to be taken place first. Remember the things that curb crimes? First, provide a good economy where the people don't have to steal. And if they have that good financial environment and they still rob and steal, then they are to be punished. So here these individuals maybe are using perverted interpretations of it. Still seems to be in line if you ask me. But let's notice some desires that differ very quickly. Is it the case that all Muslims want to subscribe to Sharia, especially these harsher sides, these harsher punishments? Relatively few Muslim societies faithfully observe these harsher sides of the Sharia. This being true, we have to wonder what the majority really wants. One person quotes a Muslim who says this, "I long for their revival." That's his attitude. "I long for their revival. It's something that I long for, that we have a revival throughout the Muslim world because it would help society." Well, listen if you will to this. Islamic states are presently renewing their legislation, replacing it with earlier Islamic structures, and are trying to rid themselves of the influence of colonial powers. They hate the West, remember? In most of the Islamic countries, endeavors are underway to make the Quran and the Sunnah the basis of modern legislation. Remember, those are two sources of Sharia. Not all Muslims agree with this retreat into the Islamic Middle Ages of earlier times. Our world has become much smaller, they say. Through modern travel and telecommunication, the influence of humanism, rationalism, technology, and modern living have left their mark on many Muslims. Because of this, one-third to one-half of the Muslim population in Algeria, Egypt, Turkey, Pakistan, and Indonesia resists the introduction of the Sharia. They do not wish to come under the yoke of oppression again, one that would demand that thieves have their hands and feet amputated, adulterers be whipped, and converts to other religions be put to death. However, one-third to or one-fourth to one-third of the Islamic population passionately demands the immediate introduction of the Sharia and is prepared in some places to enforce it with the help of terrorism and revolutions. In each Islamic country, fundamentalists and liberals wrestle over the Sharia. In Syria, these differences led to a civil war in 1982. one in which the army brutally defeated the uprising of the Muslim Brotherhood. Turkey was already rid of the Sharia by 1926, emerging as a secular state. But in other countries, a re-Islamization is underway. There are certain terms that we need to listen out for when we hear individuals talk about Islam and talk about terrorism and things of that nature. Have you heard of Islamists? Islamization? This is the pursuit of ideological Islam. This brand of thinking views Islam as more than just the final revelation come to supersede Judaism and Christianity. It sees it rather as the true key to power in the world. They want to take over the world. Listen, if you will, to these words. There is nothing abstract about this kind of power. It is worldly. This is what the Muslim wants. The faithful. By the way, that was mentioned earlier also. Whether these are extremists, fundamentalists, as if these individuals have hijacked Islam. Keep in mind that Christianity in its purest form is peaceful. There have been individuals who have perverted it. There have been times in history where certain things have taken place under the heading of Christianity that were not Christianity. Christianity in its purest form is peaceful. Islam in its purest form is violent. Anyone who claims to be a Muslim and does not hold to that theory is what we would call a liberal. Islam is violent. Now, back to this idea of taking on the world or of overcoming the world. This power under consideration is temporal, and it's of this kind that the Muslims enjoyed for the first millennium of Islam. Throughout that period, Muslims ruled vast empires. They led the world in cultural innovation, and they mastered the sciences. Now, many Muslims wonder and ask why it is that foreigners have come to dominate them and why the Islamic world is poor and unproductive, left far behind the West and increasingly by the Far East as well. The Islamist, the one who wants to introduce the Sharia in every nation, he thinks he has the answer. He says that Muslims have fallen away from the essence of Islam personified by the example of the Prophet Muhammad and codified in the Islamic law, the Sharia. Muslims, he says, will remain in their wretched state until they purify themselves by reinstituting this law. If Muslims do as the Prophet did, if they are willing to implement the law of Islam without apology and rely on their faith and revelation to defy the great powers of the day, then this world will be theirs. We better open our eyes. The events of September 11th just encourage that even more in the mind of the one who wants to be faithful to his religion. That's exactly what they're going to have to do. If they want this law to be enacted, that's exactly what they're going to have to do. Those kinds of acts. This implementation begins by repossessing the state, as explained in this quote. Only the state has the material means and the coercive force to Islamize itself and society. Islamism, therefore, cannot remain content to function as a social movement. To fulfill its destiny, it must capture the state and rule. Think again about what Brother Price said just a few minutes ago. It must capture the state and rule. In the book, I ask this question. One has to wonder what will happen to the judicial systems and countries that welcome Islam's arrival and influence. If we close our eyes and pretend that this religion is peaceful and nothing more, and we allow them to take over, we're going to be in trouble. That's precisely what they want. That's their aim. And apparently there are a lot of individuals in positions of power in this country and in other places in the world who are willingly opening up the doors, refusing to tell it like it is. Now, we say all of that to come back to the question, are we supposed to be for this thing or against it? When it comes to those severe punishments that we talked about earlier, are we supposed to be for the Sharia or against it? Never mind all of the emotions that come along with the idea of these things being brutal. We can go to the Bible and find some things that some might consider to be brutal. Here are punishments that work. They curb crime. So are we supposed to be for it or against it? Can we support it? No. Why is the answer no? The answer is no because this legal system, the system in which these severe punishments are found, are a part of a system that is based on false doctrine. The foundation is faulty. The whole thing crumbles. Remember, the Sharia claims for itself, and the Muslim claims that it is a way to God, or the way to God. What did Jesus say? I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one can get to the Father but by Him, not the Sharia. That's why we must oppose it. Now, what about those parts of this law, though, that seem to line up with the Scriptures? They're right not because they come from this Islamic system of jurisprudence. They're right because the Scriptures said that they're right. And we hold to certain justice because God says that it's right, not because this man-made religion backs it. We cannot endorse anything to do with this religion. They may claim to follow the same God. They may claim some sort of allegiance to the same Jesus that we follow, but there are stark differences. And we must oppose this religion and everything involved in it. It is false, and it will cost men their souls, not to mention their lives. Thank you.